Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the kickoff for Silicon Valley Reads 2017, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, Santa Clara County Library District, San Jose Public Library, De Anza College, and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Nancy Howe, and I am the Santa Clara County Librarian and co-chair of Silicon Valley Reads, along with Mary Ann Dwan from the Santa Clara County Office of Education and Jill Bourne from the San Jose Public Library. Our theme this year is And Justice for All, and it's my pleasure to introduce the author of one of this year's Silicon Valley Reads featured books, Adam Benferrato. Adam Benferrato is professor of law at Drexel University in Philadelphia. His undergraduate degree in history is from Yale University, and he graduated from Harvard Law School in 2005. He has taught at Drexel since 2008. In addition to the New York Times bestseller, Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice, he is the author of numerous articles in legal and cognitive science publications, as well as major newspapers and magazines such as the New York Times, Washington Post, and Atlantic. He has been interviewed on CNN, PBS, and other radio and TV shows across the country. Moderating tonight's conversation is Sal Pizarro, columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Ladies and gentlemen, please help join me in welcoming Adam Benferrato and Sal Pizarro.
Thank you for being here with us today, Adam. It's an honor for me to be moderating this conversation for Silicon Valley Reads. Every year we do try to pick a theme that we think is going to resonate with our community, and every year we're kind of surprised that how much it does resonate and how current events seem to overtake what we're doing. And that is again the case this year. Now, obviously, you heard how far in advance we were planning our theme and resulted in the selection of your book. You were working on your book long before we were thinking about this topic and before the United States and a lot of people around the world were thinking about it. What inspired you to work on Unfair?
That's a great question. I think it really started for me actually in law school very, very early on. I think I went to law school, like many of my students today, I think, with the notion that I was going to be helping people. I had a kind of an activist idea. I think I imagined myself like Atticus Finch or someone kind of standing up and fighting for the voiceless, fighting for against corrupt cops and big corporations, evil corporations, and things like that. And I imagined that, you know, the tools that I would have would be the law itself, and that being an advocate for social justice was just about sort of memorizing all of the statutes and all of the precedent. And pretty early on, I started to become disillusioned. I started to think that what I was being taught wasn't actually what was moving the legal system. Oftentimes, it seemed to be judges' personalities or what was going on in America at the time the case was decided that was determining the outcome. And I actually remember going to the office hours of my very famous constitutional law professor, Larry Tribe, and I sat down and I said, you know, I really appreciate what you're doing in the classroom. Professor Tribe has a tendency to sort of try to show everything as consistent. He'd create these wonderful charts of how actually, you know, over this period of 200 years, the Supreme Court's jurisprudence actually all fit together and made sense. And I said, you know, a lot of times it doesn't seem consistent to me. Why don't we instead study, you know, the backgrounds of the individual judges and their psychology? Doesn't it matter that, you know, five of the judges are Catholic? Shouldn't, and, you know, these three live in McLean, Virginia. Don't those factors make just as much difference?
How did he react to that?
Well, he said to me, Adam, that's just not my thing. And so I thought at that moment, well, maybe that could be my thing. And I decided, you know, really very early on that I wanted to be a law professor. And I started working with the Project on Law and Mind Sciences at Harvard Law School and started reading as much of the psychology and neuroscience literature that I could. And the more I read, the more convinced I was that the entire building blocks, the foundations of our legal system were based on assumptions that weren't true. And that makes sense. I mean, I think that our assumptions about memory, about why people commit crimes, about what deceit looks like, they were all formed over a period of hundreds, if not thousands of years, where there was no psychological experimentation, where there was no data collection. So why would we expect them to be correct?
Well, because it's the way it's always been, right? We rely on precedents a lot.
I mean, it's very interesting how law, though, is treated differently, I think, than other areas. You know, I think in medicine, we expect progress. We expect, you know, that we would have very different techniques in terms of surgery than we were using 50 years ago. We'd expect to have very different medicines than we had 20 years ago. Somehow in law, we think that the people who came before us were somehow more pure and enlightened. And even if that's true, and it might be true, they certainly did not have, you know, the tools that we have today to understand how real humans behave.
And you mention a lot of those tools in the book, a lot of the technology, a lot of the science that goes behind the way the brain works, the way we perceive things. Did you ever feel, while you were working on this, that you were sort of going from law professor to scientist or doctor a little bit?
Well, so, you know, I came to, I think, college with, I went to a math and science magnet school, and I was really interested. I really thought I was going to be a scientist. My senior in high school actually worked at the Smithsonian's Invertebrate Zoology Laboratory, doing sort of research on copepods, which this is really getting into the weeds, people. And I, you know, I published, you know, a couple of articles in obscure Crustaceana, the International Journal of Crustaceans.
Okay.
And I thought,
those people need jobs,
yes,
too.
I really thought I was going to be a scientist. And I went to Yale, and suddenly it was my history courses and my psychology courses and my economics courses that I felt so passionate about. But I never lost the interest in hardcore science. And so, you know, when I became a law professor, I started actually doing experimental research with psychologists. So my major collaborator is a guy, Jeff Goodwin, who's a cognitive psychologist at Penn. And I think those collaborations are so great at universities. You know, we're at a great university right now, and I think all universities are realizing that, you know, where the really great space for innovation is interdisciplinary work. And I realized, you know, writing this book, doing experimental research, I realized where my weaknesses are. And so, you know, working with Jeff is a master at all of the statistical stuff. But we design experiments together. And I think as a little bit of an outsider, I actually tend to design things a little bit differently. I think Jeff, unfortunately, he's not here to say, actually, I do all the hard work. But I think that we bring different perspectives, and that's actually what's great and why I think I think one of the reasons that I was able to do this book is relying actually on other people. There's so much great research done by other people in the book. And I think coming at it as a law professor, I see different things than psychologists see. I see different implications of their work. And I think I have a freedom that often I think psychologists, pure scientists, don't have. I think they're often reluctant to apply their work to the real world. And I think that's vitally important. I think we have to be cautious when we make conclusions and advocate for changes based on science. But we have to remember when we look at something like the criminal justice system, a lot of our practices and processes are based on no science at all. And so the fear of changing based on, say, somewhat robust but somewhat unsettled science, the risk is much less. I tend to think that the risk is often greater with sticking with the status quo.
Because the status quo hasn't really worked.
It hasn't worked
at all.
We know, from the number of wrongful convictions and errors that we've made. But we also just, I think, in my opinion, need to commit ourselves to evidence-based justice. I mean, we have evidence-based medicine. We have evidence-based business practices. You know, no longer is it the norm, if you have a multi-billion-dollar company, to just go with the gut instincts of the CEO. You now collect real-world data. Even sports teams have realized, right?
Moneyball.
You've
right.
got to play Moneyball if you want to win. And somehow, in law, we think, no, those founders, they really, really knew something that we don't know.
And it brings it back to the other major problem with our legal system that your book brings out, which is us, that it relies largely on people and fallible people and people with incorrect memories that they don't realize are incorrect. And, reading the segment on eyewitness accounts made me fear very much for ever being arrested for anything and that I should just give up at that point. What is so wrong with us that we can't remember what we think we saw?
Well, I think all of us just have a vision of our memories that they work kind of like cameras. I mean, I think that's just intuitive that when we see something, we just take a picture of it and it goes back in the file. And sometimes the file's a little bit dusty. And if we've seen something a lot, then we remember it. And I think one of the really powerful examples that I use in the book is this little trick in which, I tell you, and I'll tell the audience, those of you who've already read the book will obviously know the answer. But I want you to think and describe a certain person that you've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of times. So I want you to think for a moment about what this person looked like. What's their hairstyle? Do they have sideburns, receding hairline? What kind of nose do they have? Kind of a ski jump? What do their lips look like? Okay, so here's the person. Person on a $10 bill. What does he look like? Another question, what's his name? I asked my students this
Lin-Manuel
the other day.
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah, right. I asked my students, good answer. So still, I asked my students this the other day in my law and mind sciences class, and no one could describe what this person looks like. And it just shows seeing something doesn't commit it to memory. Seeing something hundreds of times doesn't commit it to memory. And one of the things I think that's really scary about eyewitness memory is just how reliant we are. Tens of thousands of Americans are charged with crimes each year based almost solely on eyewitness identifications.
And you're talking about people who will pull the wrong person out of a lineup even when the right person is in the lineup.
So that was really one of the most stunning moments. And there were a lot in doing this research. I came across this photograph that I got from a law professor at UVA, and it was a photo of a real lineup from 1979 down in Meriwether County, Georgia. And there had been a brutal rape of a woman. She was brought in a while after the crime, and she was shown a live lineup. And she looked at these five men, scrutinized them, and she said, "Yep, number three. Right there in the middle." And so this lanky guy wearing a white T-shirt, John Jerome White, ended up going to prison. He spent something like two decades in prison. They finally tested the DNA. And in this case, there was really very little other than the eyewitness identification. There was a hair. They did a hair analysis where they said this hair matches up with John Jerome White. But when pressed, the expert said, "Well, actually, really, all I mean is it's more likely than not that this hair matches up." So it was really just based on this eyewitness identification. Well, it turns out they do the DNA analysis. He didn't do it. Now, that was not what shocked me, seeing this photograph. There are hundreds of cases just like this, if you look at the research. What shocked me is in this original photograph, the real perpetrator is standing there. He was just locked up in the jail on an unrelated crime. It was a total coincidence. He was pulled in as a filler. Just stand here, you look kind of like the person that we think is the suspect. And the person who had been brutally raped looked eye to eye with that guy and picked the person two people over from him. And what that tells me, and what why I use this story, is it just shows to me that the threat to our justice system does not come primarily from evil people who want to do bad things, from people who have are racist or vengeful or whatnot. They are good people who have every incentive to get things right, who want to do the right thing. And that to me is terrifying. And what's terrifying to me, I mean, is not just, you know, the anecdotal evidence, but the statistics. I mean, 1/3 of the time in real lineups, these are ones actually conducted, 1/3 of the time when someone picks someone out, they pick out an innocent filler. 1/3 of the time. And if you think about that, in any other area, imagine, you know, hospitals that gave the wrong medication to people 1/3 of the time. Or brakes that failed 1/3 of the time. We would not stand for it. And yet, as Americans, we stand for it. We were talking in the back beforehand. I told you, you know, I clerked on the D.C. Circuit. One of the first cases I had as a clerk involved eyewitness identifications. And, you know, there was a problem where there had been, if I'm remembering correctly, multiple eyewitness identifications. And that's one of the real problems when you sort of bring someone initially in for a show up, right? The police, there's been a bank robbery, drive by in a car, and they say, hey, is the person sitting on the curb with their hands behind the back? Is that the person who robbed the bank? Mm. Pretty suggestive. So then, oftentimes, they bring the person in a couple weeks later and say, look at a photo array. And the problem with that is, are you remembering the person who robbed the bank or the person you saw sitting on the curb? There's no way to know. And then, usually, the prosecutor then, during trial, comes out, as in this John Jerome White case, mm-hmm. brings out, right, the witness, brings him up to the stand, says, you know, ma'am, do you see the person who raped you here today? You mean the person sitting behind the defense table? Could it be that person? Again, to the jury, though, this looks incredibly convincing. You picked out the same person 3 times. And in court, you say you're certain. So, right. You know, when I had this case as a law clerk, I printed out for my poor judge all of the cases involved, you know, all the research on faulty eyewitness identifications and brought it to her. And to her credit, she cared about that, and she read the cases. But ultimately, you know, what happened? It was, well, you know, eyewitness identifications are the foundation of our system. We're not going to get rid of them all of a sudden. And I think that's ultimately probably why I will never be a judge, because my answer is we got to get rid of them. If they fail 1/3 of the time, we've got to look another way. I mean, I look at this as a scientist and as someone who believes in justice, and I simply cannot accept a failure rate that's that high.
You probably will not be a judge.
I know. This is being recorded, right?
this is being recorded. So, and we're going to get to the other way soon. But so eyewitness testimony is faulty. So empirical evidence is what we're aiming for. Mm-hmm. And we have this wonderful thing here that we pretty much invented here in Silicon Valley, all of this technology. Mm-hmm. So where does technology help us get to a more fair place, but I think you've written, it can also hurt us.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there are near-term technological innovations that we can use, and then there are longer-term things. So first, you know, thinking about the nearer-term things, one of the obvious innovations that's really caught a lot of attention across the country in the wake of police shootings of young African-American men has been cameras, right? So what we need to do is we need to fit all officers with lapel cameras, we need squad car cameras. And I think the research there is that this can be a positive development in certain respects. So one of the ways I think that we can move away from eyewitness identifications, for example, is if we rely more on all of the video footage that we currently have. So in Philadelphia, where you know I live, a few years ago there was a murder near our then apartment. And the perpetrator was caught because of all of the cameras that were around, security cameras at the convenience store. They saw the exterminator park his car in front of this woman's house, and that's how they caught him. I think the research in terms of police officers does suggest that when people believe that they're being watched, they act differently. It shapes their behavior. There are even experiments where just putting like a big picture of an eye on the wall changes mm-hmm. people's behavior. So I think that that is a positive reason. That's a reason that we should really use cameras. But we have to use them correctly. So one of the reasons I worry about cameras is something called camera perspective bias. And the way a lot of this research has been conducted is in the interrogation context. So essentially, you know, you're the detective, I'm the suspect. We set up two cameras, right? One behind you, one behind me. And you interrogate me. And then we ask people to watch one of the videos and say whether this is a coerced interrogation, which cannot come in as evidence, or whether it's okay. It's voluntary. And you would think, well, as long as the camera captures the interaction, that's all that's needed. But in these experiments, what the researchers have found is that perspective matters a lot. When things are shot from your perspective, the detective, mm-hmm. people tend to say, well, that looks voluntary. But when they look at things through my eyes, when they're sitting in my shoes, suddenly they start to see the coercive pressure, and they're far more likely to say, actually, no, that was a coerced interrogation. That's one of the reasons that third-party perspectives can be so important. Now, there's other research that really just came out this year after the book was published, looking at the speed at which videotape is shown, right? And you would think that wouldn't matter at all. Well, determining, you know, deciding whether someone acted with premeditation, for example, in a murder case. Well, what these researchers did was they just played it in slow motion for some people and regular speed for others. When they played it in slow motion, I think the conviction for first-degree murder rate of the mock jury was four times as likely to convict. Four times.
Wow.
So little things like that matter immensely. And so that's one of the reasons that I worry about how police departments are just being very quick to adopt this as sort of a cure-all for problems. I think one of the dangers is, you know, when we have lapel cameras or cameras, you know, attached to Ray-Ban sunglasses, mm-hmm. we're seeing things through the eyes of the police. And so when we're determining, right, who instigated an altercation, how threatening someone looked, if we see things through the eyes of the police, we're going to take a very different view of events than if we see things through the perspective of the person who ends up getting shot. Or, say, from a third party,
having a camera phone.
So I think cameras are a good thing. I think, but we have to be careful with how we use them. And second of all, I think that another big thing is we have to ensure that we're recording the entire interaction. This is a real problem, and police officers are reluctant, and I understand why they're reluctant. It's incredibly difficult being a police officer. And if you can imagine in any of your jobs being recorded the entire time you were doing your job, that would feel awful. That would be really, really difficult. Yes. And so I'm sensitive to police officers, and I think we need to take their perspectives into account because they are under an immense amount of pressure and asking to have everything they do under a microscope, I think is incredibly, is a real challenge. Yet, if we only have snippets and we allow people to decide when they turn on the videotape and when they turn off, that's just asking, in my opinion, for abuse.
Well, that makes sense. And a lot of times what we're seeing as well is a lot of reliance on that perspective, watching cameras, looking at experts you've mentioned, mm-hmm. sort of that CSI effect.
Yeah, so I think there's another danger a little bit with technology, which is that I think people sometimes can sort of expect things from science and expect a certainty which simply doesn't exist. And I think that's been one of the real dangers, particularly with forensic analysis. We tend to think when, you know, we've all watched the shows, right, where the fingerprint, you know, it's 10 minutes from the end of the show, and they put it into the big, you know, computer database, and, like, it lights up, flashing red. We have a fingerprint match, and they rush to catch the perpetrator. It's not like that. Right, there's a lot of subjectivity that goes into bite mark analysis, fingerprint analysis, hair analysis, even DNA analysis. Now, this is an area where everyone thinks, well, that has got to be
right. It either is or it
that
isn't,
has got to
right?
be cut and dry. We're learning more, particularly when, say, there are multiple suspects. There is a level of interpretation, and one of the challenges is confirmation bias. Very often, the people who are doing the analysis, when they are matching up that fingerprint, they know about the case, and they know that this fingerprint has come from someone who, say, has already confessed. Or they know this comes from a suspect who two eyewitnesses have already identified. And unfortunately, when we start with those blinders, we do what we all do when we start with a theory. We find evidence that confirms what we already believe to be true, discarding evidence that we believe is contradictory. So, you know, I discussed this example, and again, it was a very small-scale study, but they basically sent out, there was a, it was like a gang rape case, I believe, and they said, told a bunch of DNA analysts, this comes from someone who, you know, the four other people in the gang rape are all agreed to a plea. This person is holding out and saying that they're innocent. So we just need to match this person's DNA up as one of the contributors to the sample. And so when they sent this out, I think all the DNA analysts said, yeah, it's a match. They then sent it to, I think, 17 other DNA analysts who were not told the backstory. Like, one out of 17 made the match. And again, that's a small sample, but what that shows is just the power of confirmation bias. We, you know, when we are told, right, this is someone who's already confessed, people, detectives, we all start to look for evidence that lines up with that. That weak, you know, eyewitness identification, the witness who was kind of uncertain, suddenly looks like a really certain witness when we have that confession.
And we've certainly all dealt with a little bit of confirmation bias recently in an election where a lot of people thought one thing was going to happen and that's what they saw and mm-hmm. were very surprised when something else happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes beyond the legal system. I want to pick your brain a little bit and get into the future.
Yeah.
So in the book you go through how witnesses are fallible and lawyers are definitely fallible and police officers are fallible and judges and the prison system's fallible. So it seems impossible to remove the human factor from the legal system, but can we? And I know you have an idea on this.
So as I was saying, I mean, in the book I try to sketch out things that we can do today, right, to take the human element. So, you know, we have technologies being used in some major cities like Panascan, which we take this amazing camera that basically sits in the middle of the room and takes a picture of everything in 360 degrees and high level of detail. Then you don't have to rely on, right, the memory or notes of the police officer, right? We actually can go and look at that photograph. So that's something we can do today. But I think we also have to be thinking about sort of what our justice system is going to be looking like in 50 or 100 or even 200 years in the future. And so I think, you know, when we start to take the evidence seriously, which suggests, for example, we say justice is blind, but we're frequently led by our eyes. So we know that African American defendants, receive higher bails. We know that they receive longer sentences. In fact, it's not just whether you're black or white. It's how stereotypically African American your features are. So in interracial crimes, those with the most stereotypically African-American features, wider noses, darker skin, thicker lips, are even more likely to receive the death penalty. We know that more attractive witnesses are more likely to be believed. We know that jurors focus on non-diagnostic cues to deceit. So people tend to focus, when they're trying to determine whether someone is lying, on eye contact, shaky limbs. Those things don't reveal deceit. Very clear in the wide-ranging research that's been done. So one thing that I think about is, well, what if we really blinded people to those elements? What if, in fact, we move to virtual adjudication?
And how would that work?
So I imagine a future in which everyone sort of owns virtual reality, Oculus Rift-type technology, and this might be 100 years in the future, and everyone could actually be a juror in their own home. So you right now, in order to be a juror in the United States, you've got to take off work, go to the courthouse, we've got to schedule it, find time to do all of this. But imagine that actually you've got jury duty and you just, over a course of a month, had to at some point go down into your family room and put on your virtual reality headset, and suddenly you were in a trial. And everyone was represented by neutral avatars who had been designed to remove all of the biasing factors that currently we use. So what would that mean? Well, I think it would get rid of a lot of the drama of trials. I think our trials...
Half the TV schedule would go away.
It would. And I think, what makes for good drama makes for bad justice. I think the bombastic attorney gesturing up there, the criminal, right, who looks like a rapist, right? I think that makes for bad justice. I think we tell people that cases are decided based on the law and the facts. But we don't do the things to ensure that they're decided on the law and the facts. And I think, to me, moving to basically virtual trials would allow us to do a lot of other things. So one of the other, I think, real benefits is that we could actually edit out moments that were biasing. So one of the things that we know from research is that when, say, impermissible information is presented to a jury, say the fact that someone has previously been arrested for an unrelated crime, doesn't make it more or less likely, says the law, that they committed this current crime. But if that gets brought up and the judge says, no, actually, the normal way it's dealt with is the judge then instructs the jury, forget what you just heard.
We can all do that.
And the jury shakes their head. Well, can people forget information that they just heard? No. Can judges forget what they just heard? No. But what if we pre-recorded things, we could just cut that out so they never heard it at all? I think that would be greatly beneficial. Now, I've just been working on a piece for a magazine targeting judges in which I asked the question, well, what if we even went further? And because I'm in Silicon Valley, I think it's fair.
We're innovative.
Fair to think about that. What if in 200 years we had trials by computer in which all we did was we entered in all of the relevant data that we had? Well, we have an eyewitness. It's already possible to conduct an eyewitness identification purely by computer, so we could put that data in. If we had DNA evidence, we could insert that in. If there was a confession, we could insert that in. We could insert everything into the computer. And it would all be weighed exactly based on how much weight the science said it should be weighed. The computer could know every legal case ever on the relevant legal topic. If it was an acquaintance rape case, right? the defense of reasonably mistaken belief in consent. They would, the computer would know every single case ever decided on that. One of the dangers currently is jurors, and many of you have probably been on juries, jurors are given jury instructions, definitions of what rape is in a particular jurisdiction, what the insanity defense is. Law professors teach our law students, well, it matters really a lot which jurisdiction, what definition of rape you have. Well, when scientists have looked at that, what they have found is it doesn't matter at all. Like, it doesn't matter at all whether there's a reasonably mistaken belief in consent and it's an acquaintance rape case. Why? Because each of us comes in with our lay definition, our personal definition of what rape is. And what that is defined by very often is our own individual backgrounds and experiences. And so in research that looked at this particular context of rape, what was most important, right, the most interesting division was not actually between men and women, it was within women. So older women, more conservative women who ascribe to more traditional gender norms tended to acquit in this acquaintance rape case. Younger women with more progressive gender norms tended to convict, regardless of the definition of rape. So to me, the advantage of moving to a computer is you can control for all of that. You can actually have the definition that the people of whatever state have decided ought to be the definition of rape or insanity. And the question is, would we ever be comfortable with trial by computer? And I think we will be. I think if you look, we will soon be comfortable with being driven by computers. We are comfortable with planes being piloted. I mean, today, your plane is largely being flown by a machine. We're increasingly comfortable with surgeries being done largely with the aid of computers. These are all critically important things, decision-making processes, and I foresee that in our future. Now, I don't think that it will happen in my lifetime, but I think that's where the science is pointing. I think that if we are committed to justice, we have to accept that we may not be the right people to be facilitating justice. We can put the inputs in. We can tell the computer what we value and what we care about. But sometimes we can't do. We can't be the people that we wish we were. And so that is where I see this heading. I'm very interested to hear the reactions of judges to this, but I really think that's possible. And one of the things that I think is interesting, being in Silicon Valley, the complexity of that problem is actually a lot less complex than problems which are being dealt with today in Silicon Valley. Like, that program is less complicated than a lot of the work that's already being done here.
I'm sure somebody could create that system, and it would just be applying it. That would be the difficult thing.
Right.
Much like
with
self-driving cars, they know the technology works, but you actually have to let the law and people's feelings catch up to it.
But I talk, you know, I talk about in the book this, I'm a musician, and one of the instruments I play is guitar, and I went with my dad a few years ago to the Martin Guitar Factory in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. And one of the things that I was fascinated by is they use machines. I thought Martin guitars were all made by hand. They used to be all made by hand. But what they found was humans sometimes, you know, sanded things a little bit too much on the fretboard, and then you had to throw out the instrument. Computer never sands things wrong. It's always exactly the right amount. And I to me, that's just a sign. It's a small-scale thing. But if the Martin Guitar Factory can decide, you know what, making a perfect instrument is more important, I think we ourselves, with respect to our justice system, can also accept that, you know, maybe computers, maybe automated processes are better ultimately, better stewards of our legal apparatus.
And of course, one of the things you point out in the book, though, is that we have a tremendous capacity to believe that we actually know better and the computer might be fallible, but we're not, because we're people and we have this capacity.
We do. We have this amazing faith, not just in people, but in lay intuitions, right? I mean, that's the whole idea of the jury, is that, you know, regular people possess almost these superhuman strengths, right? To see, to detect when a witness is lying, to be able to tell what's in a person's soul, what they were thinking in a particular moment. And I think that makes us feel really good as human beings. I think we like to think that we possess these special powers. But the data just doesn't back it up. I mean, I think humans, you know, going back to memory, I mean, I think humans do have amazing abilities with respect to memory, but it's just not consistent, you know? I mean, I can tell you, you know, about an incident where, you know, I was working in London as a 2L at law school, and I was in an area, not a very populated area of London. It was the last tube, and I was going down an elevator, and there was a single woman going up, and I thought, that's the woman when I was a freshman in high school I had my locker next to. And I said, Roshna. I literally probably talked to her 3 times in high school. And I thought, you know, it's, you know, 15 years later, I thought, it's Roshna. And it was Roshna. She's working at McKinsey, and she happened to be in town, and total coincidence. The fact that I can have that amazing thing, and yet a current student in my class can stop me on the way to class, and I can look at the person and think, who are you?
And you probably couldn't accurately describe the person who served you breakfast this
morning. Absolutely could not. So that's the danger.
So let's get on to some questions from the audience. There's a lot of them. We're probably not going to have time for them all, but we'll pick out some interesting ones. If you were innocent, and I think this is a key point, mm-hmm. if you were innocent but on trial for a serious crime, in which countries would you most and least like to be in court?
That is a great question. So first of all, I would say, I would call myself a patriot. I love this country, and I believe in this country, and I believe in our potential. But I think the country I would probably most fear would be the United States. And that is a shocking thing to say. But I fear our, you know, and again, I mean, that's leaving aside, you know, certain Syria, I mean, countries like that. I mean, I'm thinking about countries that are not, you know, in that category. But I think I would be most fearful probably of the United States. Where would I feel most confident? I mean, I think in the book, the countries that I think I most often focus on in terms of, I think, their successful embrace of evidence are countries in Northern Europe, I think, which have made real progress with respect to cracking down on false confessions. So rather than using techniques which we know lead people to feel highly coerced and can lead to false confessions, they use cognitive interview techniques, which are more effective in collecting data and far less likely to lead to bad information. I think I would also, you know, want to choose a country whose system of punishment I found to be just, and that is not the United States. So I think countries like Norway, the Netherlands, countries that like Germany. I mean, in Germany, you know, by
you described the German prisons,
right. And so, you know, in Germany, by law, the purpose of their correctional system is rehabilitation. That is the purpose. Now, it also can serve deterrence reasons or incapacitation, but the purpose is rehabilitation. I write about a prison in Norway, Halden Prison. This is a prison that holds murderers and rapists, but the whole idea of that prison is if you put people in monstrous conditions, you will create monsters. And it's so intuitive. If you put people in monstrous conditions, how do you expect people who have already committed bad crimes to get better? It doesn't make sense. I mean, it wouldn't work with a dog. A dog that had been abused and abuse people, and then you put it in a position where you abuse the dog more and you expect it not to bite people. That doesn't make any sense. In countries in like Norway and Halden Prison, prisoners are treated with respect. They're given keys to their cells. They make food communally together. The guards are like trained social workers. In the United States, to be a prison guard, you know, in Texas, it's like, are you 18 years old? Come on down. Well, there, yeah. They take courses in psychology, in de-escalation, all these things, and really act more like mentors. People have connections to their family. So one of the other authors, you know, for Silicon Valley Reads, Shaka Senghor, you know, mm-hmm. writes about, you know, his own experiences, and you get the sense in that book of the power of family and how it was his family, it was his connections to this woman that he met that get him through. And yet in the United States, we put up roadblock after roadblock to prevent family connections. If you look how much it costs for people to just make a phone call to their wife, like $9 for 15 minutes. In fact, denying people the right to see their children. How is that going to make people better fathers when they come out? How is that going to make better children who do not grow up to become criminals? It will not. So I think I would choose a country like Norway or Germany. But I think we have to work ourselves to make America into the country that we want it to be.
Great again?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think we do have to make America great like it's never been before.
That's the applause line. So going back with an audience question to our discussion on cameras, if we increase our reliance on cameras to determine a perpetrator's guilt or innocence, how do we still maintain, or at least not cross the line, our own rights to privacy? I mean, would we be creating a big brother state that takes things too far in the other direction legally for us?
So I think that's a really hard question. I think different people come at it in very different ways. I personally think, though, that as a country, we need to welcome that debate. And it's a debate that I have with students. I'm teaching criminal law right now, that I have with my students. And it's there are generational differences. But I ask them, you know, how much would you be willing to give up in terms of personal privacy to make the world safer? So I asked them, would you feel comfortable on the Drexel campus if every public space was under surveillance 24 hours a day? Most of the students in my class raised their hand. I asked them, how would you feel about giving your fingerprints up into a database and having an ID card for everyone in this country? I asked them, how would you feel about giving up your DNA sample so that you could quickly be ruled out of any case that came up? I asked them, how would you feel about having just a little chip in your phone so that we would know where you were so we could rule you out? And it's really interesting where people draw the lines. Different people are very different. But I think that's a conversation that we ought to have. In terms of the big brother state, I mean, I sort of think we already are in a big brother state. And that's because, I mean, if you look at a lot of my students, I mean, they are living their lives in public already. Right. And, you know, I have friends who from law school who are in counterterrorism, and they will tell you, right, most of the times when they you know, break up terrorist cells, it's not by, you know, putting in little cameras and things into certain areas. I mean, it's things people post on Facebook and things like that. And so I personally think if we are committed to justice and cracking down on wrongful convictions, part of that may be giving up certain rights to privacy. That worries me, but I think it's a conversation that we ought to have.
And we probably will. Now, pulling a couple of questions together, what has the reaction been to your book? Have you gotten reaction from police departments or district attorney's offices? Is it being taught anywhere besides potentially your own class?
Yes. No, but I'm fighting the good fight. No. I have, since the book was published, I have traveled around the country, talked to groups of judges, defenders, prosecutors. I just got asked a couple of days to talk to forensic scientists. I talked to members of the public. And I get different reactions. So I would say when I talk to members of the public, the people, it's self-selecting. And so people who come to events like this tend to be interested in criminal justice. And I may be saying some things that they disagree with, but a lot of the stuff I see nodding. When I talk to judges, I also, and it may just be the samples of judges, although I've talked to judges in different areas of the country, Ohio and Massachusetts and elsewhere, have been largely receptive. I think, you know, I went out to dinner after speaking to a group of maybe 300 judges in Ohio last year, and, you know, we were talking about the instructions that judges give out. And they know the problems with them, right? They're concerned with them, too. They think, yeah, I know that the jurors don't listen to them and don't understand. And I constantly get questions about, you know, what does beyond a reasonable doubt mean? And can you help me? So I think they tell me, you know, I'm worried about plea bargains, right? I worry about that, but I don't know what to do. So they've been very receptive, I think, to what I bring, and I think the evidence that I bring in the book. Defenders are probably the most supportive of what I do. I think a lot of them are working, you know, on cases where they feel that the person they're representing was mistreated, where they may feel that the person is actually innocent of the crime. The only area where I've been heckled at all, we'll see how the rest of tonight goes, but the only where has been with prosecutors. And I think that largely has to do not with my book, but rather with a perception and a feeling that they are under attack right now, that people don't appreciate the hard work that they do, that they're being painted as people who are trying to set folks up. And I do not believe that, and I do not write about it. I mean, I have a chapter in the book in which I talk about Brady violations, right, where, mm-hmm. you know, exculpatory information is not passed over. And I write about how good people can engage in dishonest behavior that hurts people and why prosecutors sometimes do that. I'm not blaming prosecutors for bad results, but I think that a lot of prosecutors and police officers in the country right now feel hated by, you know, half of the population, and that's a problem. Now, I have not been asked to speak formally to groups of police officers. I've heard from individual police officers. And that has been actually uniformly supportive. Now, I may start hearing from people who read my book and disagree with it, but there are a lot of police officers out there who are very interested in evidence-based policing. They want to do the right thing. That protects them. That is why they join the force, is that they wanted to fight crime, and they want to do it effectively, they want to do it fairly, and they want to do it safely. And by looking at the research, that's the best way to accomplish that. And so is that happening around the country? No. But I think there are a lot of police departments out there who are working with psychologists and working with law professors to try to come up with best practices. So I would say the reception to my book has been good. I mean, I think from people who actually read it, I think that certainly there are folks who don't read it and think, look
at
this.
They know what it is.
Well, they're like, look at that youngish. for those listening on the radio, look at that young guy, professor. What does he know?
Then telling me ivory tower.
Yeah, ivory tower. Telling, I have no ivory tower. Drexel has no ivory towers. Telling me, who's out on the street every day, what it is. And I think if you read the book, that's not at all what I'm saying. But I think they feel under attack, and I think that's something anyone who cares about reform has to take into consideration. How can we bring in all stakeholders into this conversation? Because it's going to take everyone to make progress on criminal justice reform, right? Everyone's got to buy into that process.
And it's going to take a long time.
Absolutely.
It really is.
Absolutely. Yep.
Because it's going to happen in pockets, but it'll, you know, we're too big of a country with too many jurisdictions to uniformly.
Absolutely.
Do
and you know, that can be a downside and it can be a positive side. So it can be a downside because it takes a long time to get everything changed. It can be a positive thing because when, for example, you have a presidential election and the new president appears somewhat disinterested, in my opinion, in criminal justice issues. I think there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who are very committed to tackling criminal justice reform and are really passionate about it, who understand the problem. I don't think Donald Trump, that is a major priority for him, and I hope I am wrong. But if I'm right, there's still so much that can be done because so much of criminal law and criminal justice is local or state-based, and there is a lot of passion still on those levels.
In a lot of cases, the criminal justice system begins where you are now in a university because that's where our lawyers are trained. Mm-hmm. They become judges. They become Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. What changes can be made and how we teach our attorneys when they're in law school?
So, I have tenure now. And
so you can speak freely, okay.
And when I first started teaching, I think I taught a lot more like I'd been taught. And now I teach what I think students really need. And that often goes against their expectation. I think students coming in to criminal law just expect to, like, go through the cases and, like, you know, tell me
precedents.
Yeah, like tell me the three-prong test here and, you know, tell me what the model penal code says with respect to, you know, the difference between purposely and knowingly committing an act. And I talk about a lot of other stuff. So, like, when we cover a chapter on statutory interpretation, well, I tell them, you know, the canons of interpretation, right? How the Supreme Court talks about how the statute is, you know, leading to one interpretation. And then I talk to them about the psychology, which shows that, right, all of these things are totally malleable. And probably the reason that certain judges read the statute one way is they started with a gut assumption about how the case should come out. And then they simply chose the canon of construction which supported that view. And they found the legislative history that supported that particular view. And I think that ultimately makes them better lawyers. But it makes them, it's hard, because criminal law is a first-year course, it's hard to unsettle people's faith in the system that early, so it's a delicate business.
Because then they might just be gone.
Yeah,
I'll be a
right,
social
exactly.
major.
But I see my role as creating people who really understand how the system actually works. Not the way that people assume it works, but what's actually moving law. And I also see it as my responsibility to encourage people to change things that they believe are wrong. I say that is part of your responsibility going out in the world. And I think that ought to be a core part of every law school. It's not my duty, I tell them, to tell you what's ethical. But don't just read the model rules and repeat back to me, right, what model rule 2.01 says, right? You need to decide what is moral and right. You need to decide your limits now on what you will do, who you will represent, how far you will go. Because you're not going to be able to have that perspective, right? Once you become a prosecutor, once you become a defender and you have an actual case and you have a family to support, then that's the hard time to make those decisions. You need to decide what's important to you and what world you want to live in.
We've got time for one more question. What are you working on now? What do you have? Are you doing more work in this vein?
So a variety of things. I mean, I think I'm working right now still on other pieces related to criminal justice reform. As I said, I just finished off a piece looking at sort of bolder ideas for reform. So, you know, embracing evidence-based justice means reforming eyewitness identifications and interrogation procedures. But what are the really big ideas that we ought to be thinking about down the road? I'm also continuing my experimental work, particularly looking at our motives for punishment, why people are driven to punish people and children even. Particularly I'm looking at, with Jeff Goodwin, entities that we generally consider not worthy of punishment when we make exceptions. And then, you know, I'm also trying to do more sort of out in public criminal justice advocacy work, because I think that that is something that is just so desperately needed in this country. Writing is one thing, but trying to actually encourage people on the ground to make changes in how judges do things, on how prosecutors set up their offices, I think that's critically important as well.
Great. Well, we wish you much luck in that. Thank you for speaking with us tonight. And we've been talking to Adam Benferrato. The book is Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice, and that is one of our Silicon Valley Reads books for 2017. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It was a real pleasure.